На Балканах после нескольких лет затишья может...
Сербия и Косово, как они правильно...
То есть это Босния и Герцеговина, где...
Балканы снова вернулись в зону влияния России, как это всегда...
В Черногории предотвращена попытка вооруженного...
Российские власти категорически отвергли...
Rising tensions in Kosovo, separatism in Bosnia-Herzegovina, resurgent nationalism in Serbia and an attempted coup in Montenegro. Don't look now, but the volatile Balkans are again turning into a trouble spot. In this time around... The hand of Moscow is busy stirring the pot. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there again.
And also with me in the studio is Arbana Vidišići, director of RFRL's Balkan Service. Welcome to the podcast, Arbana, and I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
Absolutely correct.
Wonderful. That's good for me. I get a gold star. So unrest in Bosnia and Kosovo, revanchism in Serbia, the 1990s appear to be calling, and they want their headlines back. But this isn't a flashback. It's happening now. Arbana, can you give us the lay of the land? What are we seeing in the Balkans right now? Why is it happening, and how concerned should we be?
Many would agree that this is the worst crisis since the 90s, actually. We're seeing an aggressiveness of foreign policy of Serbia and the inability of the leadership in Kosovo, Bosnia, Montenegro to defend itself from this aggressiveness, which is directly connected, I must say, with Moscow support.
Is that the primary driver, or is Moscow simply exploiting things that are happening on the ground anyway? Because tension in the Balkans is nothing new. This is the worst crisis since the 90s, but anybody familiar with this region knows that these tensions are always just under the surface.
You're absolutely right. The drive comes from Moscow. Look, Western Balkans was always a playground, a long-time playground for Moscow, a playground where Kremlin can test the boundaries of the possible. You have a really volatile region. You have an older Slav Orthodox brother looking after the younger brothers, which is the Republika Srpska in Bosnia, the Serb entity in Bosnia and Herzegovina. You have the Serbia proper. You have the Macedonia as well. There's a Putin regime-like in Macedonia.
Yeah, Putin-like regime, yeah.
So we're the support that comes from Moscow directly has encouraged the leaders, specifically the Serbian leaders in Serbia and Republika Srpska, to again incite this, to flare up these existing tensions.
How much of this is related to the fact that the West is less engaged in the region than they were, and the United States in particular is less engaged in the region than they were?
That's also true. The United States have been, since the end of the last war in the Balkans, which is in Kosovo, it ended in 1999, was less and less engaged and more engaged in other parts of the world, Middle East specifically. And this is, whenever you leave the Balkans, the Western Balkans, into a vacuum, there are always going to be some interference, either from Kremlin or from other parts of the world, like we've seen from the militant group ISIS. So the higher the engagement from the Western powers, the lower is going to be the Russian influence. Unfortunately, Russia has invested a lot in machine propaganda. In Serbia, we have 110 NGOs that are functioning in Serbia. This is a huge network. We have a lot of Kremlin-sponsored media in Serbia, in Republika Srpska, in Macedonia too, and they all have one vocabulary that's anti-NATO rhetoric, anti-Western rhetoric. So they all goes into one thing, which ended up with 67% of the people in Serbia being in favor of alliance and historical ties with Russia.
Now, I want to come back to you in a bit and talk about what's happening specifically in each place. But I want to go to Mark and say, you know, I mean, I argued on the Daily Vertical this week that Russia's actions in the Balkans are part of what I call Vladimir Putin's relitigation of the 1990s. The West's intervention in the Balkan Wars in the 90s and its prevention of the creation of a greater Serbia under Slobodan Milosevic has long been a sore point for the Kremlin. And it often seems to me that Moscow views Serbia's dominance over the former Yugoslavia as almost a metaphor for Russia's dominance over the former Soviet Union. And now it seems Moscow is trying to restart the Balkan game again. What does Russia have to gain from this? What is its goal, do you think? How does it fit in with the larger narrative of what we see Russia doing in the world at this time?
Well, it's precisely in this context of a perceived ebb of American involvement and, frankly, European Union capacity to involve as well. And in this respect, I mean, in some ways, I think there's probably two competitive priorities. One is this imperial sphere of influence type notion. But on the other hand, I don't really think Serbia in and of itself is that important. It has a certain sort of symbolic, cultural, but above all, it's a political instrument. Precisely by stirring up the Balkans, it poses a challenge to the European Union, a challenge to the West more generally. So, you know, it's basically asking this question, so what are you going to do about it? Because the expectation is that either the West will be unable to do anything about it, in which case it is clearly a sort of, you know, a symbol of its weakness and its disunity, or it does something about it, which, depending on what it is, either sort of embroils it in a whole variety of expensive economic, political, or potentially even military interventions, and also gives Russia another chance to say, look, the sort of behind the nice rhetoric of the European Union, you have a neo-imperialist state. I mean, I think from his point of view, this is something which at relatively limited expense to him, could have a potentially major payoff. But precisely, I think the real payoff is not actually in the Balkans. It's part of his wider political campaign against the West.
Suppose he ends up not getting a free hand, but not a lot of pushback. What's the end game then? Is it a bunch of client states? What's he after here?
Well, I mean, I would say absolutely. I mean, from his point of view, you know, the hope is to have a series of client states and just simply a sense that the European Union has been tested and found wanting. But we've got to realise, I mean, you know, this is not just about what Putin wants. It's also about what other players want. And the interesting thing is that, you know, even if one looks at Serbia, who are clearly sort of setting themselves up exactly as the Russians, not just allies, but also proxy and getting benefits from that, not least the T-72 tanks and MiG-29 planes that the Russians have given them, which are not leading-edge technology, but absolutely in Balkan terms, they are militarily game-changing. But at the same time, you still have Serbia committed in the long term to membership of the European Union. I mean, again, I think this is a classic example that all empires face, is that the imperial power thinks it is the chess player and doesn't realize that often the pawns and the bishops have their own agendas at the same time.
Well, and that's another interesting thing in the change of Russia's policy, because if you talk to me 2-3 years ago, I would have said Russia's policy vis-a-vis Serbia, and they were not opposing Serbia entering the EU at that time, was to basically they wanted a little Trojan horse in the EU. And now they seem to be shifting in that approach, and I'm not sure what explains that. Do you have any
idea? I do have a hypothesis here, and again, it kind of links into how I feel that Russian politics works, which is I've sort of called an adhocracy. That people kind of fit in to different roles, firstly as the Kremlin wants them to be used. It doesn't matter if they're businessmen or generals. If the Kremlin wants to put them in a certain role, it will. But likewise, everyone also has their own agendas. And here, I think the key thing is Nikolai Patrushev, the Secretary of the Security Council, who was also the guy who was deployed after the failed coup in Montenegro to go and sort of quickly calm things down, who has been putting quite a lot of emphasis these days on the Balkans and has specifically said that NATO membership of by Montenegro, Macedonia and Bosnia would actually be a threat to Russia. I mean, I'm sure Montenegro would like to know that the addition of its military strength to NATO somehow represents some terrible challenge to the motherland. But it is almost as if, you know, at a time when, as it were, one can see other theatres as being clearly the key responsibilities of certain other figures. It's almost like Patrushev has either been given or has taken the Balkans as his.
And Patrushev's a player. I mean, he's exactly. probably one of the most influential of the Silivki veterans that remain in Putin's inner circle with the departure of Sergei Ivanov. I'd say Patrushev is number one.
And also, I mean, and he's still very clearly thoroughly embedded in this mindset of a kind of a Manichean dog-eat-dog struggle with the West. I mean, this is a guy who has said, probably believing it...
He's the biggest ideologue of the
United
bunch,
States
yeah.
would like there not to be a Russia. You know, I mean, he really believes this is a struggle. And therefore, again, I think if you've got that, frankly, Soviet-era mentality, that any defeat for the West is a victory for us, and likewise, any defeat by us is a victory for the West, well, then the Balkans give you the perfect opportunity to cause hassle.
Yeah, and if you're Putin and you throw Patrushev at an issue, it means you take that issue pretty seriously.
But I think it's not that Putin has thrown Patrushev at it. I actually suspect that it's as much as anything else, it's Patrushev, A, because he genuinely sees this as one of the battlefronts, but B, also kind of, well, where's my war? You know, this is a time when actually a lot of players are precisely making their careers on the basis of perceived successes. Patrushev has up to now spent a lot of time, frankly, pushing paper and knocking heads in the Security Council. Now it seems he wants to get back into the field.
And he's not getting any pushback from the big guy.
Not at all. I mean, obviously he sold this idea. He said, let me have the Balkans. And the big guy has indeed said, knock yourself out.
If I can just go ahead and give one interesting fact that I came across. When Russia annexed Crimea and when Putin addressed the State Duma, the first address after Crimea's annexation. Did you know that he mentioned Kosovo six times?
Yeah.
So this is some kind of revenge also in that chess-playing game for the what happened by the dissolution of Yugoslavia, and then the parallels with the dissolution of Soviet Union, too.
And now, ironically, the president of Kosovo is accusing Russia of assisting Serbia to pull off a Crimea-type annexation of northern Kosovo. I wanted to go back to you, Orbana, basically to go through, for the benefit of our listeners that might not be following this as closely as we are, what is going on in each of these places? Because we have unrest in Kosovo. We just had that incident with that train that was manufactured in Russia trying to get across the Serbia-Kosovo border. We have a Republika Srpska seeking to hold a referendum on greater autonomy. And we have Russia pushing to get rid of the high representative in Bosnia, the UN-appointed high representative. So we have a lot of things going around. If you could kind of just walk us through each place, what do we have going on in Kosovo?
First of all, Kosovo has never had any control of its northern part of the territory, which is... from the Ibar River in Mitrovica city. And that still, this bridge that we're talking about over this river is really tiny. That's my hometown, and I know it really well. It's really tiny. You can cross it in 2 minutes. But you have completely different life over on the northern part of that bridge. And completely.
The northern part is primarily ethnic Serbs.
So it's inhabited by the majority of Serbs, and then it's interconnected. Of course, it borders with Serbia. Look, we just had this dialogue in Brussels, EU-facilitated dialogue between the presidents and the prime ministers of Kosovo and Serbia. And the result of the dialogue was to ease tensions. And this dialogue came nearly 4 years after the agreement between both countries was reached to normalize relations. So all those agreements in between and all those discussions in between were basically... reflecting the ineffectiveness of that dialogue. I'm not against the dialogue. I'm not propagating that. I'm just saying that they were not effective enough. And I would like to interconnect here with Mark, who said earlier that that's absolutely the ineffectiveness of EU to push things forward in the Balkans. They just had those agreements and then both sides went on and interpreted however they wanted. The train row, that was a blink. Just a blink away.
Yeah, what do we see in general happening in northern Kosovo now that's new? Because these tensions, again, have always been there. But what do we see happening now that's new that makes this makes people, a lot of people think a new Kosovo crisis could flare up at any moment?
Yes, it could. And in northern part, there's only one part of that life that Kosovo authorities control, and that's Kosovo police.
Mm.
Electricity, water, railways, everything is under Serbia.
Mm-hmm.
even the currency. You buy in the northern part of Kosovo with dinar, and you buy with euro on the southern part of the river. So it's, if really Serbia wants to annex it, it's not going to get, it's not going to be that difficult if we're talking about practical annexation.
Right. And what do we see happening now? What's happening on the ground?
Only the next step is like getting them to Brussels again and to talk. And I think it's going to be in the next 10 days. But the situation is Salvini, and after that dialogue, the language of the both presidents, but primarily from Serbia, Tomislav Nikolic, was that I'm ready to go and fight.
Mm-hmm. And what are we seeing in northern Kosovo itself? Are we seeing that the local Serbs are getting more restive?
The local Serbs are actually the biggest victims there, I might add, in the northern part. It's their leaders, and that they will not allow them to function normally in their daily lives. There have been a lot of Kosovo Serbs who have lived in the north that have signed up for Kosovo passports, but they were afterwards publicly lynched for doing so. So the real population, I would call it a victim of the big broader politics, which is led by Belgrade towards Kosovo, is the aggressiveness of Belgrade, as I said, foreign policy, sponsored by and supported by Kremlin, which is not allowing Kosovo to go forward to get some more international recognition. Still, Kosovo's independence anniversary is February 17th. Mm-hmm. It's going to be 8 years now, and they still don't have over 110 recognitions.
Yeah. Now, there's also tensions in Bosnia-Herzegovina, particularly in Republika Srpska. What we see there can we call this separatism? I called it separatism in my introduction. Was that over the top, or do you think we're seeing separatism in the RS?
No, it is the separatism, and they advocated openly. When I say they, I mean about Milorad Dodik, the president of Republika Srpska, who has also said that the biggest dream of his is to create the independent Republika Srpska and to separate it from the Bosnia and Herzegovina. Milorad Dodik has been sanctioned by the U.S. lately. I listened to his reaction very carefully after those sanctions were announced, and his rhetoric and his vocabulary on separatism against the U.S. ambassador to Bosnia was absolutely out of the line, and you cannot even imagine that there's some politician might talk like that in the Balkans after the war. And after the Dayton Peace Accords were set.
And now we do have Russia trying to get rid of the institution of the High Representative in Bosnia-Herzegovina. But other than that, where do we see the hand of Moscow in Bosnia and Kosovo stirring up this trouble?
In both countries, the aim is to find some tools. In Kosovo, they found Belgrade. In Republika Srpska, they found Dodik, supported by Belgrade, to mitigate Western influence in these both countries. In Russia's eyes, in Russia's views, Kremlin's views, Kosovo and Bosnia are the projects of Western projects, specifically U.S. projects, you know, Kosovo's independence and Bosnia's Dayton Accords. And so they're using every tool possible they have just so they can unsettle the membership towards Western structures.
Now, you mentioned these 110 NGOs that are operating. These are primarily in Serbia proper. Are they active in Bosnia and in Kosovo as well, or how does that work at the societal level?
The first two NGOs that Russia ever opened in the Balkans were in northern part of Kosovo. That in 2008, when Kosovo declared independence, then they tested that ground, then they went on with Serbia. Some of them are open. We searched as RFERL. We went after them. Some of them are inexistent. Some of them are humanitarian centers, like the one which is in Niš, the city of Niš, and it's governed by both governments. And they say it's a humanitarian center, but to many, it might be even a spy center. Mm-hmm. That's what some Western circles are saying. So the target is, as far as we could tell from our research, youth, changing the minds of youth. When we ask those young people, would you rather be in an alliance with Russia or the EU, they say, oh no, we're going to be with Russia at any cost. And where would you live was our next question. They replied Germany, Finland, Denmark. So that's the...
Mark, you see any patterns here that fit kind of larger Kremlin projects?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is the sort of the classic toolkit. The thing is, the tools are not that unusual. Precisely, you know, propaganda, elite capture, using a whole variety of structures, and where possible, finding alliances. I mean, if we go back to that niche humanitarian centre, I mean, it is patently a sort of a power projection instrument. It's not actually as if the Russians were thinking, we need some more humanitarianism in Serbia, let's see what we can do. So the instruments are all very familiar, but the point is it's because essentially of the continuing failure of the state-building processes in the Balkans that actually makes this area particularly vulnerable to it. I mean, let us be perfectly honest. The European Union has failed the Balkans. You know, if you look at somewhere like Montenegro, which, yes, has all kinds of corruption problems and others, etc. But nonetheless, the point is there is a vicious circle at work. You know, a sense of exclusion, a sense of, frankly, hopelessness actually breeds a variety of problematic attitudes and short-termism and so forth. I think the thing is it's as it were, it's the standard Russian playbook, but it's just we're now getting a sense of just how effective it can be when there are not the defences of strong alliances, strong sense of solidarity, strong civic culture, etc. How dangerous it can be.
How in places like Kosovo and Bosnia is the other side reacting? In other words, are the Kosovo Albanians getting radicalized as a result of this? Are the Bosniaks and the Croats and Herzegovina, for that matter, getting radicalized as a result of this?
You're absolutely right to ask that question. Let's say Kosovo, other part of the ordinary citizen. Kosovo is the only country in the Western Balkans that doesn't have visa liberalization. Kosovo, on the other hand, has the biggest ever EU mission in place, which is overseeing the rule of law. And did you know why Kosovo citizens don't have visa liberalization? Because they lack progress on rule of law. So the lack of perspective, the lack of all these countries, Kosovo, Bosnia, low GDP, high unemployment, poverty, when you mix with all these political situation that is actually stagnating the economical growth in all these countries and job rates, then you're, of course, are breeding practically generations of radicalized people. And the risk is always potentially there. We keep saying this, repeating, Balkans has always been and might always be, I'm not sure about the future, but a ticking bomb.
And so we are seeing radicalized Kosovar Albanians, and in Bosnia as well. Is it getting radicalized on the other side of the...
They are getting radicalized because now if you take the Bosniak Muslims and the Serbs about discussing about the separatism and the Bosniak Muslims saying, no, we will not let them go, then you have the third entity, which is Croatians, and they want now their own separate entity. So there's separatism and federalization talk all over again in Bosnia.
No, we haven't talked... Oh, go ahead, Mark.
I just say, I mean, and the trouble is, unfortunately, again, bringing this back to the Russia factor, this is actually fine from Russia's point of view. You know, if they actually had some blueprint for, we want to have a Russian-dominated Balkans with our, Serbian proconsuls, then, in fact, obviously what they would want is to take over, but to take over an orderly region. They don't, ultimately. What they actually want is to cause a complete crisis for Europe. And in that respect, actually, from their point of view, it's just as good when you have Croats and Bosniaks getting radicalized as Serbians, because what you want is the trouble. You don't really care that much about the outcome. I mean, sure, if they had to choose which side would they want to win, they would want the Serbs rather than others. Right. But essentially, it's the chaos which is the aim.
Now, we haven't talked about Montenegro yet, where there was an attempted coup, and there was alleged Russian involvement in that coup using as proxies Serbian nationalists, if I'm not mistaken. Walk us through that, Arbana. What do we have there?
We have so far the information that the Montenegro prosecution has indicted and actually issued international arrest warrants against two Russian citizens for their alleged involvement in the attempted coup, jointly with some of the Serbian citizens which have also attempted the coup. They were detained. they were questioned, and some of them who have been earlier engaged, and this was also publicized by RFURL, as mercenaries in Ukraine in Donbas region. So now most of these guys that were in Donbas region have been declared under witnesses under protection by the prosecution because they're cooperating with the prosecution. For now, there are two citizens of Serbia who still remain in Serbia. They're under custody, and they're waiting for the paperwork to be finished, to be extradited to Montenegro. One of them was pictured with Sergei Lavrov while he was visiting Belgrade on December the 13th.
Now, this appears to be a direct Russia-Montenegro thing. It doesn't appear that Belgrade was involved in this, or was it? This, from the reports I've read, it did not appear that Belgrade was involved.
No,
Belgrade wasn't happy about it.
It wasn't happy about it. They kept quiet for a while when they heard that there were Serbian citizens involved. If I'm not mistaken, the first reaction from Serbia's prime minister, Vučić, came about 12 hours or even 24 hours later.
Now, which raises an interesting thing in terms of how Russia is playing with Serbia, because Serbia was not happy with Moscow. And again, this gets to the point I wanted to make. The linchpin of this whole thing is Serbia. And Serbia is divided. Serbia is divided. Its official policy is to join the EU. How do we square that? Mark, I don't know if you want to jump
in. Again, it goes back to my earlier point about actually pawns not being pawns, but everyone having their own agendas. Of course, from the Serbs' point of view, the Serbs are not sitting there thinking, well, we love Russia so much, we're fine with being the springboard for its attempts to create more conflagration in the Balkans, whatever it costs us. No, of course not. They're working out how can we basically leverage Moscow's interest to our own advantage and keeping it within the parameters. Because, yes, clearly, look, just like the youngsters that Ivana was talking about, who sort of talk about their great sympathy with Russia but would like to live in Germany. So too, in some ways, Serbia is in exactly that same position as a country. You know, who do you feel the emotional sympathy for, and where do you actually see your personal, your national interest being? Obviously, it's with the West. And this is one of the reasons why Patrushev, I think, did have to go back there quickly to
mend fences.
I mean, it looks like it was a GRU operation, and frankly, it was a fairly sort of opportunistic and shoddy one in many ways. But nonetheless, I think it speaks to the limitations of Russian capacity. Mm. They cannot assume that they have, just some absolute subordinate actor in place. They are in a position where, just as the Soviet Union did with Afghanistan, with Cuba and all its other sort of clients, it has to cope with the fact that even if it has the sort of the dominance, the clients are going to be basically working out, well, what's in it for us?
Right, and they have their own fish to fry. But if they had pulled this off, and you say this was a shoddy operation, but they could have done it. They could have pulled it off. And if they had pulled it off, Montenegro is about to join NATO. That would have probably ended that.
Yeah, I mean, Arbano will know much more about me specifics, but as I said, the chances of actually pulling it off in terms of actually taking over power and holding on to power, that seems unlikely. I mean, again, I think we come back to this point of what is Russia about? It's about chaos. I mean, what it would have done was actually create a huge headache, and absolutely would have probably put, at the very least, a temporary obstacle to joining NATO. But again, I think this is the thing from Russia's point of view. You're just going in there to break stuff. that is so much easier. I mean, as we know, especially in a region like the Balkans, than building anything. Russia doesn't care. Russia doesn't care about the Balkans. It doesn't care about Serbia, really, except maybe in the most sort of broad and general terms. In terms of its strategy, it's just going in there to cause trouble. And that, unfortunately, is relatively easy in an area like this. Because even by failing, that coup attempt has created a whole variety of new tensions and pressures and suspicions.
Yeah. Before we move on, there's another thing I wanted to touch on, and this is the whole media disinformation, fake news, buzzwords of our time thing. Because we see this all over Western Europe. We see this all over Central Europe. We see these alternative news sites popping up that are you know, stealthily and sometimes not so stealthily pushing the Kremlin line. How much of this do we see in the ball? I know we see a lot of it, but can you flesh it out a little bit for us, Urban? What are we seeing?
Yeah, that in all of the countries of the Western Balkans, of course, these countries are not immune to this new phenomenon that the whole world is facing. But mostly, besides the fake news, and we in Serbia, in Bosnia's Republika Srpska, Macedonia, Montenegro, we are seeing a lot of Kremlin-sponsored media. And I'm talking Sputnik, I'm talking Russia Today, I'm talking radio shows, I'm talking free weekly magazines that are being given to these citizens of any of those countries.
The way it's done, I mean, looking like here in the Czech Republic, we'll see a lot of things that look on the surface like they're straight up media, right? Probably 80% of their content is just straight news off the agencies. But embedded in that is just plenty of, if not pro-Kremlin, Euroskeptic, things that fit the Kremlin narrative. And so it's kind of this stealth kind of shrouded Kremlin propaganda that's, I must say, very, very sophisticated. Are we seeing it that way as well? That they look like they're local sites run by Kosovars or run by Bosnians, but in most of the news is just normal news, but then there's a lot of propaganda slipped in there as well. Are we seeing that kind of a model?
Absolutely.
Because I've always said the danger isn't RT and Sputnik, because everybody knows what they are, right? The danger is these other so-called alternative news sites that don't look like what they are at first glance. And you have to really look below the hood to see what they're all about. And they are shaping narratives. And the pattern we're seeing in Central, Eastern, and even Western Europe is that you will get narratives that start on RT, and then they'll get picked up by one of these kind of camouflaged local, so pseudo-local news sites, and then they'll seep into the mainstream media at the end of the day. Are we seeing that kind of pattern where things are starting on RT Sputnik, getting into this kind of media, and then ultimately ending up on quote-unquote respectable mainstream news?
Yes, zones? Absolutely. And even not just only those local domestic tiny sites that you might think that there's two paragraphs of news bite on it. There's also an NGO parallel. There's this really researchable NGO in Belgrade, which is led by Jelena Milic, and she has been under police protection because of her research that she's done on the Russian influence in the Balkans. There's another NGO which bears exactly the same email address, exactly the same URL, just one letter mix up. Even like office. And it's led by a person who sometimes comes up as a Western analyst into local media. And as you say, you have to look under that, what he or she says from that NGO. So they're using NGOs and the local media and everything to put that in place.
Well, that's a really interesting story, because that again, another example of how Russian domestic politics plays itself out in international politics. In the 90s, when I was working in St. Petersburg, we had the phenomena of the dvojniki, the double. And essentially, it was basically in a local election in St. Petersburg, and guess where Vladimir Putin is from, St. Petersburg. There were candidates for the local city council, and they would suddenly find running against them, you'd have Ivan Ivanovich Ivanov, and you'd have five other people with the exact same name running in the exact same district, and voters, of course, couldn't figure out which one was the real one. And this we're seeing this exact same tactic working internationally. In a few moments, we will shift gears and take a look at some of the turbulence in the criminal underworld following the arrest in July of one of Russia's top mob bosses. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations at Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also with me in the studio is Arbana Vidicici, director of RFRL's Balkan Service. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Молодой Well, it's been a while since we talked about gangsters, but hey, why not? We got Mark here in the studio. In the internet newspaper Znak this week, there was a report that power struggles are surfacing in the Russian criminal underworld in the wake of the arrest of Zakhary Kolashov, otherwise known as Young Sharho, in July. According to the report, Russia's security services have made it clear to Russia's gangsters that they need to keep any power plays under wraps until at least after the March 2018 presidential election, and preferably until after the Football World Cup in June and July of 2018. Mark, you're our gangster expert, and this is your comfort zone. What the hell's going on in the, if anything, in the Russian criminal underworld after Young Sharho's arrest near half a year ago? Are we seeing this turbulence, or is Znak just kind of, you know, trying to sell newspapers here?
Well, far be it from me to suggest that Znak's trying to sell newspapers. No, actually, I mean, there is turbulence. I will put a slightly different perspective on it. I don't think this is about a competition to who's going to become the boss of bosses, because Russia has never had, and don't think would have, any one such figure.
Was Young Sharho anything close to that?
I mean, he was a major player, particularly after you have figures like Tarja Lonjani going to prison, and
Jed Hassan
was being killed. I mean, in a way, after a certain point, you begin to start losing senior figures. But I think it's more that what this actually says is it's not so much about the sort of one individual. It's about this continuing brittleness of the underworld order. This is order that was kind of emerged in the late 1990s, was basically fossilized in the 2000s, particularly when the Putin regime made it clear big turf wars were no longer acceptable, and then has become increasingly basically put under pressure by some big changes in, shall we say, the marketplace, the rise in the flow of Afghan heroin through Russia into Western Europe, the impact even of sanctions. And counter-sanctions, sort of creating new markets, particularly sort of smuggling through Belarus and so forth. Now, all of these, in pure market terms, should have changed the underworld. They should make some gangs get stronger and some gangs get weaker. But in a way, there's been an artificial maintenance of the status quo. And therefore, there is this concern that as soon as you start something that might begin to sort of cause a little break in the system here, the cracks will stretch right across the country. So I think that there is a situation in which you get a whole variety of different rivalries being played out. There is a broad one of the Slavs versus the Caucasians. Mm-hmm. There is a generational one. In some ways, there hasn't been enough killing, which is not something I would want to say. But in terms of the underworld, usually what happens is people keep getting bumped off, and therefore there is social mobility. Now you actually have a situation in which a lot of people are standing around. Exactly. And therefore, so you get the hungry 30-somethings and even young 40-somethings thinking, well, when is it my turn? Mm-hmm. And we've seen that. So there's this constant struggle to try and maintain a frankly increasingly untenable status quo. Mm-hmm. And the state is one of the players in that. Precisely. I mean, again, it's interesting, this notion of keep things quiet until after the presidential elections or ideally the World Cup, because this fits a pattern we've seen. Sochi, there was a very clear sense of course you're going to make a lot of money out of Sochi. But anyway, you make your money beforehand. You buy property and then sell it on over expensively and so forth. When it actually comes to the event, then it has to go really smoothly. And if anyone messes, you know, if we start seeing evidence of sort of serious attempts to predate the foreigners, things that will embarrass the motherland, we will come down very hard. And organized crime understood and played the game. The very fact that when Putin first came into power, again, there was this edict that went out saying, look, you're going to continue to do your thing, but the sort of indiscriminate killings, the drive-by shootings, the car bombings, which had been a feature of the 1990s, they've got to stop. And indeed, they did stop. So you have a state as a player. And the last point I'd make is one of the uncertainties. It's interesting because Znak is right that a lot of the kind of people who are coming up and wanting to assert their power actually are Russian Slavs. Historically, ironically enough, there's been this little triumvirate to try and keep the status quo. The state, the Slavic gangs, and the Chechens. Mm-hmm. The three who benefit, basically, from the status quo the most. Now, if you're going to start getting Slavs actually defecting to, shall we say, a revisionist side, that actually might well, either it'll actually weaken the state's capacity to keep a lid on things, or indeed it might actually force the state to get much more heavy-handed.
Right.
So, I mean, all of these, I mean, again, I mean, it's one of these situations where this could explode next week. Mm-hmm. It could stay the same way for 5 years.
How much did removing young Sharko from the equation affect this?
Not particularly, except insofar as he was one of the last figures who was still able to be something of a bridge between groups. He'd been in Spain for a sort of big chunk of his time. You know, he had a lot of respect within the underworld, but in some ways he didn't have his hands quite so dirty from the criminal's point of view. I mean, clearly he was a crook through and through. But in terms of, he hadn't accumulated such a huge array of existing enemies and so forth. So he could still be that. But to be honest, I think that's actually, for me, a bit of a red herring.
Uh-huh.
It's not so much about Shahrazad's departure. This is actually a process that has been bubbling along mm-hmm. for some time. And it will continue to do so long as you're trying to artificially maintain
right.
a system beyond the point where it actually works.
Now, you famously said, and I'll never forget this quote, Russia's not a mafia state, it's a state with a nationalized mafia. How does this changing environment in the underworld play into that? Because what I understood you to mean by that, by a nationalized mafia, is that when it so chooses, the state uses the mafia as a tool of statecraft. Mm-hmm. To carry out operations that it doesn't want its fingerprints on, so to speak. How is that changing the equation and the relationship between the mafia and the state?
To be honest, that I don't think changes, because the state is still, without any doubt, the biggest gang in town. No one individual criminal grouping, network, or gangster can stand up against the state. But what we are seeing is the state having to put more and more effort into maintaining the system as a whole. So it's still terribly strong compared with the individuals. But actually the system, and in some ways, I mean, if one wants to draw a very, very sort of far-fetched comparison, think late Soviet times.
Mm.
When you actually had, you know, the Soviets desperately trying to maintain an economic model, which clearly just did not work.
Right.
And was increasingly not working. And so they were pouring more and more resources into it until eventually it broke. Well, in some ways, that's what we're getting. The same way as the late Soviet system could, if it chose to, could reach into any factory and spend money on it and retool it and so forth, while the economy as a whole was falling into disarray. Well, so too now the state can reach out, make any gangster do what it wants to do on an individual, on a retail basis.
Mm-hmm.
But the system we've seen, this interrelationship between state and upper world and underworld, that is actually becoming increasingly more problematic.
So it's going to be more difficult for the for the Kremlin to use the underworld as a tool of statecraft, as a tool of
politics. I think these are two separate. I mean, I don't think so, because as I said, I mean, it will always be strongest party. I think it's more that, in fact, it'll be more difficult to stop the underworld from breaking into the kind of explosive adjustment to the marketplace. I mean, so it'll still
but
be able to say...
But wouldn't that, by extension, make it harder for them to...
Unlikely for it. I mean, yes, if you're in the middle of a mob war, you might not be able... You know, a particular gang might not be... But then...
Be able to pull off a wet up for you.
Yeah, these things tend to be... This is not a kind of a global war of everyone against everyone at the same time. I think, it is more that, in fact, it becomes harder and harder to make it... To draw these neat lines... you know, if the state is having to basically reach in to try and ensure that this particular gang can do something for it, it's going to have to protect that. So mm-hmm. I think more and more, actually, it's the question of the order
right.
of the underworld that is under threat.
Well, we've done the crooks. Now it's time to do the spooks. It's Mark's birthday, and he loves to talk about crooks and spooks. So we're going to talk a little bit about spooks, because in the news this week, something happened that everybody's still trying to connect the dots on. And I'm speaking, of course, of the arrest of a series of FSB officers, allegedly for espionage. Somebody named Sergei Mikhailov, who is the deputy chief of the FSB Center for Information Security, was apparently arrested in December and is apparently facing espionage charges, apparently for passing information to the Americans. According to some media reports, Mikhailov had secretly been a leader of a notorious Russian hacking group called Shaltai Baltai, or Humpty Dumpty, that had previously hacked the emails of senior Russian officials. This gets weirder and weirder the more you read it. Mikhailov was allegedly suspected of tipping U.S. intelligence off to the information about the Russian server rental company King's Servers, which has been identified by cybersecurity experts as a nexus used by Russian hackers in their attacks against the United States. Novaya Gazeta reports that a second FSB officer, identified as Major Dmitry Dukuchaev, was arrested, and according to RBK, and this is where it gets really interesting, Dukuchaev was previously a hacker known as Forb, who had been recruited by the FSB after being arrested for credit card theft and recruited into the FSB. But he was identified as having the rank of major, which I found very, very, very interesting. A third figure, Ruslan Stoyanov, who is an employee of the cybersecurity firm Kaspersky Lab, was also apparently arrested. And according to some media reports, there is a fourth figure also arrested. This all took place back in December. This all took place shortly before the U.S. released its intelligence, the unclassified version of its intelligence report on Russia's alleged hacking of the U.S. elections. Mark, what do you see going on here? Connect the dots.
Heavens, I wish I absolutely could.
I mean, I can't. If you can, I certainly can't.
It's too early to be certain. I mean, it seems to me that there are two narratives which at first glance look entirely separate, but which actually might connect. One is that this is actually part of sort of internal, the usual sort of internal power struggles and such like. And the other one is that this is definitely genuinely an intelligence case. Now, I lean towards the latter, that actually this is an intelligence case. I don't know if these people were agents of the CIA or simply were in some ways compromised or accidentally leaked information or whatever. I mean, the presence of sort of hackers in the ranks is not surprising. Again, if we're talking
about... With the rank of major?
Well, they're obviously very good hackers. No, I mean, this is about the nationalized criminals.
Yes.
And let's be perfectly honest, the Russians are not unique in essentially trying to recruit hackers. It's just that they are relatively, shall I say...
Good at it.
Well, shall I say equal opportunities? For the criminals in their ranks, as the Soviets were, let's be perfectly honest. The number of bandits who ended up becoming sort of generals of the NKVD, hardly worth mentioning. So this probably is actually an intelligence leak of some form or another that is being cleared up. The question is, though, and you were sort of saying, well, why now? Why come out
now?
Yeah,
this is why now? Because these were arrested in December. It was quiet. It was hush-hush then. We didn't hear anything about it at the time.
Well, and of course, I mean, we should also stress, actually, by the way, there's no suggestion that this is connected to the DNC hack.
Not yet.
Not yet. But no, I think that was a different type of operation.
No, it was the voter registration.
Precisely. But I wonder if, in fact, domestic politics explains the actual leaking of the information and it coming out, that either this was sort of basically a reprimand, a rebuke to the FSB for having messed up, and also possibly suffering, because although the actual, and going back to the DNC hack, although that seems to have been done by the GRU, that particular operation, certainly what I'm hearing is it was the FSB that actually made the case for leaking it and using it as part of an active political operation. So it might well have been just simply a kind of revenge, well, this didn't quite work out how you're expecting. Mm-hmm. Now you've got to carry the can.
I mean, a lot of dots do connect here. One of them is the timing. These arrests happened in early December. The U.S. released its unclassified version of its intel report in early January. And of course, we know intelligence services don't like to declassify intelligence because of compromising sources and methods. Well, if the sources and methods were compromised as a result of these arrests, then there's nothing really to lose from making the information public. It also explains why the U.S. intelligence was able to say with high confidence, if you had sources as high as the deputy chief of the FSB's Center for Information Security, no?
Well, this is why I've always felt it was something of a red herring when people were saying, oh, this is a very disappointing report the American intelligence community have put out. They're not explaining clearly through
it's a declassified
computer
version.
Well, yeah, but even so, I mean, I don't think it was actually through simply forensic computer analysis that they demonstrated it. I mean, I felt that, and obviously they couldn't even hint at this, but yes, they had other human or intercept intelligence that was actually backing it up. And this would, I mean, again, we're just drawing lines between dots and hoping to make a picture. But certainly this would fit with this. Because I think precisely it's actually from pure computer work, it's very difficult to have that kind of right. confidence.
Well, yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're the spook expert, but when you read intelligence reports, the thing that people look for are these high confidence. The level of confidence is very important in spook talk. When you say we can determine with high confidence, that's almost saying we have a high human intelligence source on this, right?
Not necessarily human intelligence, but certainly it is that point where they're saying, trust us, we really do have this one.
All right. Well, this is a story we will be sure to keep our eye on, and we'll wrap it up on that note today. That's all we have time for. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also with me in the studio has been Arbana Vidišići, director of RFRL's Balkan Service, and I pronounced that correctly 3 times, and I'm really proud of myself. Thank you both for an enlightening discussion. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.